Good morning. My name is David Sincox. I am the Graduate Education Officer, and I'm very pleased to welcome you. Thank you, Aaron. Could you all just recognize for 1 second what Aaron has done? Aaron is a graduate student, a PhD student, and she's working through that process. But she spends time coordinating this workshop for you. So I'd just like at the beginning to give Aaron Lafferty a round of applause just for all the effort she's put in. Thank you, Aaron. This event is one of our flagship events. It happens twice annually, and I'm very happy to see some of our postdocs in the crowd. I'm very happy to see our master's students and our PhD students. We have an excellent lineup for you today, and it gives me great privilege to introduce our first speaker. The topic of this morning's lecture is what I wish I had learned when I first started teaching. Your speaker this morning has been at McGill for roughly 30 years, and she's been doing teaching and learning research and teaching in classrooms for that time. But I bet you when she first started teaching, she didn't think that she would become the director of teaching and learning services. In 2005, our speaker became the director of what is now teaching and learning services, and in the last 8 years, she has transformed what teaching and learning is at this university. She works on teaching and learning spaces. So in this room, if you look around, it's very precarious to get up to this stage even. They are looking at renovating this space to make it more geared towards an active learning environment. And in many of the classrooms you sit in now, she has had an impact on their development, on the environment, and the technology there. She also works with other projects, such as the Nexus Between Teaching and Research for undergrads. To give undergrads the opportunity to do research so that it enhances their learning. And the final point is her work with graduate students, most relevant for most of you. She works on the pedagogical preparation of graduate students, and so I'm very pleased that she's here today to talk about her experience. Last point, 2010, she was recognized with the Lifetime Achievement Award by the Society for Teaching and Learning in Higher Education for her contributions both here at McGill and nationwide, and even, in fact, globally, for those contributions. She is an amazing woman, and I'm very happy to introduce our morning plenary, Professor Cynthia Weston.
Thank you for that beautiful introduction, David. I'm humbled. Thank you so much. I was really thrilled to be invited to come this morning and talk about what I wish I'd known about teaching when I started 33 years ago here at McGill. It really made me reflect on what was it like when I first started, what's changed, what have I learned, and what would be kind of the critical pieces. I mean, you learn so much over a period of time like that when you're teaching and supervising graduate students, which I've done for a number of years. So I really tried to distill that down to a few things that I remembered particularly and things that had changed and that I thought might be of interest to you. Three immediate things came to mind when I started to think about what it was like that first year. When I arrived here, and I wasn't even 30 years old, and I had never taught before. The only thing I'd done was teach one class as a TA, one class in one course, one two-hour session, so I had no experience. And the first thing that I remembered, of course, was how anxious I was. My hands would shake, my voice would shake. It really was a struggle for me. And I was thinking about that when I'm here this morning, and I'm used to public speaking now, but at the time it was really a challenge. I read some of your burning questions that some of you submitted, and I saw that that's an issue for others as well. The second thing that came to mind is I would look out into a classroom, and I would think that the students were bored or they were disengaged. I would look at their faces, and I put here two examples that always come to mind for me. I had one student who looked at the ceiling. And I thought, I'm so not getting through to this guy. It really bothered me. And there was another one who would close his eyes. That really bothered me a lot, because, and I would tend to focus more, unfortunately, on those than I did on the ones who were engaged and who were participating. That really, it sort of dragged me away from my focus. I'm going to talk more about all of these as I go along today. And the third thing was I didn't have a clue how to assess student learning. I remember, how do I come up with those letter grades? How do I come up with those number grades? I didn't know how you would assess learning and make it add up somehow to a number or a letter. I'd never had any experience with that. And I hated giving a low grade. I agonized over it because I felt everybody had worked hard, and I agonized over it. Again, I'd seen some of these in your burning questions, and so I'm going to address three things that I wish that I'd known about and talk about different facets of these that kind of address those three memories that I had. And the first one is what I'm going to call the affective side of teaching, the one that we don't talk about as often. And then I'm going to talk about how to evaluate student learning, what I learned about that. And finally, teaching and learning as a partnership. So I'd like you to start for a minute. Think for a minute. What do you remember most about your favorite teacher? Did something come to mind for everybody? Anybody need some more time to think about that? Just take a minute, turn to the person behind you or next to you, and just tell them what that was that you remembered. And is there anything similar about what you're remembering?
They smile a lot.
Just talk to each other first, then we'll talk as a group. Talk to the guy in front of you. There's the guy. I hear a lot of energy around this conversation. I think there's some memories coming up here. So let's do a shout out. What do you remember most? You said something.
Smiling.
Passion.
Funny.
Passion.
Energy.
Quirky. Remembering your name. Incredibly
choreographed show.
Oh, an incredibly choreographed show. That's okay.
Engagement. He knows his stuff.
Engagement. If you think about some of the things that you've mentioned, a lot of those are what I call the affective side of teaching. Passion, that they're engaged, that they're funny, that they're smiling. They also know their stuff, they're organized. This is a study that was done, and the thing that most students remember about their favorite teachers have to do with exactly the things that you've mentioned. That they incited interest or curiosity, that they had a passion to impart knowledge, exhilaration, inspiration, that they were fun, they were humorous. They had enthusiasm, they were committed, that they were compassionate, empathetic, that they were caring. So it's interesting to think about what are the things that we remember the most. I mean, we also remember that they really know their subject matter, but this is what tends to always come to the top. And that surprised me. I didn't know that when I learned about that, I found that surprising. Another one that's huge that comes up very, very often is caring and concern. And by caring and concern, it's about some that we heard here, taking the time to work with students, getting to know them as individuals, remembering their names, listening to them, asking them for feedback. So these are the things that when they ask people who've been out of school for a long time, even when they're in school now, these are the things they remember, what I call this affective side that we don't always talk about. Now, does affect play a role, if we think about these kinds of things that we just sort of named as affective, in how you decide if a class is going well or not? For those of you who are, you know, TAs and sitting in a class, do they help you decide whether a class is going well or not? If students are learning or if they're having problems? Have you ever thought a class went terribly and found out later that it went well, or vice versa? Thought it went really well and found out later from feedback that maybe it didn't go so well? These were questions that I wondered about. And I became aware of some research on reading student cues. That they're named in different categories, but these are three that tend to be that we've heard from award-winning teachers and excellent teachers are the ones that they pay attention to when they're looking out at a class and trying to decide if things are going well or not. They look at what they call a student state. These are just kind of subjective interpretations of what's going on out there. You know, these are some quotes. I sense that they understand it. So it's just a sense. There was no energy in the room. Somebody said energy about one of the indicators of a teacher. But we can feel that the other way, too, right? That there's no energy in the room. Verbal, and it sort of extends also to noise levels. They're quiet this semester. And sometimes that's interpreted as, you know, it's not going as well. I must not have explained anything any better because they're asking me the same questions again and again and again. One for me is noise. Like the noise that just went on when you're talking, you can really feel that energy. Noise level to me is a real indicator of what's going on in a classroom. And you can, if you listen next time you're teaching, you can hear when it goes down, and that's the time that you need to start again. Nonverbal. Facial expressions, like the ones I was talking about, you know, looking at the ceiling and the eyes closed, that they're fidgety, they seem bored. So we pay attention to all of those things, and I'm sure it comes to your mind, some of those things, even in your own classrooms when you look around at your peers. But certainly when you're teaching, it's very apparent. So what we do as instructors is we learn how to monitor those things and interpret those things. And it's something I want you to start to pay attention to because, as we know, this piece is really important for students. So it provides a window into the learning experience. And what they found is that inexperienced teachers don't often think about that. And that the experienced teachers really rely heavily on these impressions. And they make a lot of decisions about their teaching based on that. So I want to give you an example of when I was misinterpreting some of those cues. And that was a big learning experience for me. It was the third week of a course, and the students seemed bored. They seemed low energy. And I thought, well, this course, I had changed my course. I'd redesigned it. And I thought, oh, this new design is not working well. I was really feeling upset about that. And I said to myself, you know what, I'm gonna go back to the way I was teaching it before. But I decided, and I can't remember what triggered me, but I decided, well, let me ask the students. I think maybe it was because I was beginning to learn about these things. Let me ask the students how it is for them. What's happening for them? How's it going? And I asked things, how are you feeling about these certain aspects of the course? And one of the things I said is, and how is time passing for you during the class? I taught from 5 to 8 at night. It was often, and it was a low-energy time for students. And I was so surprised when I got the feedback back. They were loving it. They were feeling engaged, saying it was one of their best courses. And the time was passing really quickly. They couldn't believe that it was suddenly 8 o'clock. And I thought, boy, did I ever misinterpret what I thought was happening in the classroom. So I think that's a really important thing for us, is to pay attention, but check on it. you know, check with a few people, ask a question, do a survey, figure out if what your interpretation is, because it takes us a while, I think, to learn about what do those faces mean, what do those affective cues that we're getting mean. And the good news was I didn't have to change the course, and I ended up using that particular design for quite a while. So that was an important moment for me. So kind of summarizing that piece, this affective side, both our affect that we generate and our reading of the cues that the students generate, can facilitate or they can impede teaching. So it's just something to keep in mind. And the positive emotional states and experiences are the most important for students. We see that again and again in the research. And for us, those positive or negative reactions that we're hearing or feeling, pay attention to them. Take some time to learn how to begin to interpret those things. Because those are not the things that we're focused on the subject matter. We're not often focused on this piece that I call the affective side. But now I want to go to the second thing that I wished I'd known about teaching, which was how to evaluate student learning. It was such a struggle for me. I want you to take a minute and read these quotes. When I started to come across these quotes, it really surprised me because I sort of thought of teaching as my content knowledge and communicating that in an effective and in an organized way, which of course is important. But I didn't realize that how we evaluate student learning, what we put in a course outline as an evaluation plan, that's how students define what they're supposed to learn. Well, think about it for yourself. Do you ever say, how am I going to be evaluated in this course? You know, what's going to be on the test? Do you ever have those kinds of things go through your mind? Or you look at the evaluation plan and you say, oh, well, I need to be thinking this way because I have to do a research paper. Or I need to be thinking this way because it's multiple choice. The evaluation defines the curriculum and defines for students what it is they think they're supposed to be learning. That's not how I started. When I started, I was evaluating learning the way I'd been evaluated. I tried to create multiple choice questions. I didn't know really how to do it, but that's how I'd been evaluated, so that's what I tried to do. And then I started to look at this, and I started to look at my multiple choice questions, and they weren't at all the level of learning I was wanting to evaluate. They were more facts, and that wasn't what I was after. And I also hated giving low grades, as I said to you earlier. I just hated that, and I struggled when students didn't do well. So take a minute and read this one. How many of you have ever heard of portfolios as a way of assessing student learning? Not a lot. And it's been around for quite a while, this idea of portfolio evaluation. So that's what I started to do. I started to use portfolios, which meant that students would collect together in a notebook all of their assignments across the semester. So I moved away from like a midterm and a final, and I moved more to multiple smaller assignments throughout the semester. They would do a draft of an assignment. They would get feedback from peers. They would get feedback from me. They could revise it and resubmit it. They would do peer evaluation, and they'd do self-evaluation. And I'd ask them to reflect as time went on, you know, how's it going over the semester? What are you learning and so on? And the grading was only done at the very end, after assignments had been submitted, revised, in this iterative process, because what I was really after was learning. I wasn't after just doing a test and putting a letter or a grade with it. I wanted everybody to learn. This is what it looked like. This is just a consolidation of what was in my course outline. So you can see here that going down the left are the assignment numbers. And so you can see there's a check mark every time they sat in class and they exchanged their papers and they gave feedback to each other. So it gave them responsibility, too, for thinking about what was being evaluated. And they had to do, you can see, a reflection 4 times during the semester, and they had to do a self-assessment 4 times during the semester. I gave them very specific criteria that they were supposed to be looking at, so everybody knew what those were, and then I only graded it at the end. It was a change of culture for the students. You can imagine that there was a bit of resistance because it's more work for the student. It's a little bit more work for the instructor, too, but you take some of the pressure of grading off by having the peer assessment and the self-assessment, and you're really doing the main grading at the end. But you're giving feedback throughout. It was a culture change. They said it was hard, but they said they learned more. That was my goal. So I also used another approach that was a culture change, but it helped, again, with this idea of how do you come up with a grade and how do you give people optimal opportunities to learn? So I use what I call contract grading. It's an old concept, and you can use it in different ways. You can do it in terms of quality. This particular one was in terms of the kinds of assignments that led up to a final assignment. So you can see up there for a B-, you had to do the final assignment, plus you had to participate in the classes. You had to submit 1 question for each reading. For a B, you had to do everything for a B-, plus you had to do, like, drafts of the first part of the final assignment. And you had to write a summary and response of the feedback that you'd gotten from your peers. For a B+, the same thing, everything for a B, plus the other things, and so on and so forth. One of the things that this required was developing trust, because the students said, you know, is this really possible? I mean, are you really giving me a choice? So they would have to say, this is what I'm working for. I'm working for an A. But what really surprised me was that some chose to work for a B. Some chose to work for a B+. Some chose to work for an A-. That took that awful struggle away from me of really agonizing over low grades, because it was their choice. It gave them an opportunity. Whoops. It gave them an opportunity to decide how much effort they wanted to put in. Because, you know, you have a lot of courses. And you can't always do the, sometimes you choose, there's one you're not going to do as well in. Or you're going to do a B and you're fine with a B. I was really surprised that people wouldn't all choose an A. And it gave them choice, it gave them responsibility, and it took some of that pressure off of you. So it became a shared experience. So, summarizing how to evaluate student learning, I think it may be one of the most important tasks that we have as instructors, because that's how the students define what they're supposed to learn. So whatever you put in your evaluation plan, they're going to look at it and say, oh, that's the level of learning you want from me. That's the kind of learning you want from me. I think portfolios are a great strategy. It's not always easy. In a big class, it's harder, but it's a great strategy for enhancing engagement and student agency. You know, student agency is part of the learning process. And providing choices for evaluation or choices for kinds of assignments, it allows students, again, to take responsibility for the learning. So this third one may not surprise you. The third thing is about teaching and learning as a partnership. And that's really well substantiated in the literature now, but that became so important to me that this whole teaching and learning enterprise is a partnership. It's not about me teaching. It's about students also taking responsibility for learning. So I'm responsible for sort of planning the overall content and the learning experience and the nature of the learning experience, but the students are responsible too. They're responsible for actively engaging in and making decisions about their learning. Some people use metaphors for teaching. One of my colleagues used the metaphor of an orchestra, that the teacher is the orchestra conductor, but everybody has a really important role to play in learning their part, playing their part in the learning enterprise. And that really what teaching is about us mutually constructing meaning, that we're trying to guide and help students in their learning. So there's kind of a shared authority. That's what that choices in evaluation, gives a kind of a shared authority. It's not just about you giving a number grade or a letter grade. One person uses this image for us to think about as the teaching and learning partnership. The student should be in the front seat, and we should be in the back seat. This is Baxter Magolda, who's done a lot of research on learning in university, that we should be the, you know, kind of helping along, but we should not be the ones in the front seat. So it really kind of shifts your way of thinking about teaching and learning. So to kind of bring it together, this notion of a shared partnership, it shifted my focus from my teaching to student learning, and that took away a lot of the anxiety that I had, because it wasn't as much about me and what I was doing, it was about what we were doing together. It was about connecting to the students. I was more attentive about watching for and validating cues, and I put here the thinking face to remind myself, you know, those, the guy looking at the ceiling and the one with the closed eyes. I learned later that there are lots of different faces that people make when they're thinking. And that's one of the things we have to recognize. There are different thinking faces. And when I started to get assignments from those people, I realized that they were thinking. They were totally engaged. They were some of the best papers that I got in the course. So they weren't disengaged and bored. They were thinking. That was my misinterpretation of their cues. So there are different ways we can go about getting information about what those faces mean that you see. Evaluation and assessment became really central to me as the most important thing that I was doing. I think it's important for students to take responsibility for their learning as part of the teaching and learning process, not just for us to feel it's solely our responsibility. And it very importantly to constantly give feedback and guidance. We know this also from the literature that's very, very important for students in helping them achieve their learning goals. So I wonder if you have questions or comments. Yes, there's a microphone here if you feel like getting up, but you don't have to.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much. That's a beautiful presentation. And I wonder, one of my burning questions, and actually the biggest burning question, is that there's so much learning in your experience and so much research done on learning and teaching, and yet you see so many people teaching at the very high level education or at all levels, actually, and they actually don't bother to learn from your experience. So they say, okay, I know enough about math, about management, about whatever, and I'm here to teach. So why is it that there's this discrepancy, that there's this misuse of, or lack of benefit, if you want, from your experience, and why is there resistance to actually take and learn from each other?
I don't know that I have all the answers for that. Before I answer, does anybody else have something that comes to mind that you might respond? No, that you might respond? No. Yeah? You have a response? Something that comes to mind? They don't have the passion? Might be? Yeah?
It might take a little bit more work,
too. It does. It does take more work. Particularly initially, it takes more work. Once you've done it, then it continues to carry through. And in fact, it is more shared work on the part of the students and the instructor. But initially, it does take more work. Yeah. Did you have another idea for what? Yeah. That's a really, really good point, and I think that's an important one. One thing that happens when you teach in an interactive way, and by the way, we know that when students are actively engaged, that their learning is much deeper, and it's much more long-lasting. It gets integrated into their cognitive system in a much deeper way. But you can't cover as much content, and that's a really hard thing to give up as an instructor, is covering the content. So what a lot of people, and there's a an award-winning teacher in Canada who teaches introductory biology from Western. And he always says, you know, you have to give up covering the content, because even if you cover it, they're not going to remember it. It's too much. You're putting too much in. What you have to do is identify your critical concepts and give people practice and feedback on those. But it's hard to let go of that content. You feel that it's so important for people to hear about it. And what's hard to accept is that it's not like an open, you know, open the top of the head and pour it in. It's not going to stick. So does that? So I think it's a more work. It's a different way of thinking about it. And usually we hear, but I've got so much content to cover. That's the one we hear the most often. And that's a longer change process. I mean, look, it took me 25 years. It was like 15 years into my teaching before I changed my assessment. So don't think it happened overnight. It's a long process, and you do have to have kind of the commitment that you want to do it.
I really like this concept of portfolio evaluation, but I'm just thinking, I mean, it's something really new for me. The first time I heard it, and I really like it, but I'm thinking, are there other evaluation ways too? I mean, if I would be exposed to other ways, maybe I could choose between them.
There are lots and lots of methods of evaluation. I'd be very glad to share those with you. And in fact, maybe we can post some. Do we have a site we're going to post things on? We've got a selection of things where you can look through multiple ways. And I wouldn't suggest going to portfolios, you know, overnight if you were using a multiple choice approach. It is an incremental, slow process. So you make small steps towards that. But we can post some documents about multiple ways to assess learning, and we're having an increasing number of workshops about it too, so we can make sure to send those out for you.
Perfect.
Yeah. You're saying if you're not doing the whole course, but if you're just doing a few sessions, is that what you're saying? How do you get fast?
Yeah.
Well, there are multiple ways. You're working in a lab, is that what you're saying? Or you're thinking about a lab setting?
Yeah, sometimes I do that sort of for my professor.
Right.
And I can see the students, I know they evolve in your class.
So okay.
I'm trying to, like, I think I would also keep the session in. I want to get some assessment of feedback. I want to get them involved.
Okay. I have some thoughts, but I want to see if other people have dealt with that themselves and have some ideas to share. You have something? Whoa. You do journaling? Journaling online. Okay.
So, teachers, I think that the time I spent writing my journals, the response, the feedback that I get is quite similar. It's from her because she provides extensive feedback. Sometimes it's very lengthy. She tells to tell Ema score during that feedback. And you think, you know, I think that my time spent journaling is equal. It's, you know, it's similar, synonymous with her time spent. So I can learn a lot from that process.
So one idea that's being suggested here, I lost you, where? Oh, there you are. One suggestion is that you can use an online forum to ask students to provide you with some feedback. How did that class go? What worked well? What didn't work well? Those three questions, even two questions, can give you a lot of feedback. What worked well in this lab? What didn't work well in this lab? What would you like to see happen next lab? That will give you feedback as to what's happening in terms of their thinking. Another one that I really... Oh, did we have any other ideas before? Another one I really like that I've used a lot in larger classes is what's called a one-minute paper. And you just have somebody, you say, okay, take 1 minute and write down for me the three things you learned from today's lab and hand them to me. You don't put your name on. It's not about names and it's not about grading. But you hand them to me as you go out the door. You look at those and you get a sense of whether they were getting the concepts you were working on that day. And if you see they're not, then instead of going on to the next topic at the next lab, you start with giving feedback and you say, here's what I learned about last one, that we got this concept and we didn't get this one, so let's go back and cover that one again. Does that give you a couple of ideas? Okay. Yeah.
Again, in terms of changing your assessment stuff, did you find that you had resistance from the university?
I wondered if that was. Well, yeah, in my department.
Here's the thing, and this is almost a philosophical position. What some departments, some faculties look for is what's called a normal distribution, right? Some people do really well, most of the people are in the middle, and some people don't do well at all. I don't agree with that. I want to see a skewed distribution, and I want it skewed at the higher end, because isn't that what it's about? I mean, aren't we here to help people learn? It just always bothered me that what we wanted were some people not to learn. I just didn't get that piece. So I wanted to skew it to the positive end of the distribution, which is why I gave multiple opportunities. But I know in some departments that's questioned as an easy course. So that becomes kind of a battle that you just have to have with your chair, and you just have to keep saying, here's how I'm doing it. It's not that it's an easy course. In fact, in some ways, it's more demanding. But you have to really show the evidence of how it's planned, how it's thought out. And so people came to accept it. But it's a challenge, and in some departments, way more than others. So that becomes, we can talk more about that.
Giving the students the choice of the tools that they need for how much they want to learn.
Giving a choice about how much students wanted to learn.
She has a question about that.
It's their responsibility, making their responsibility.
Right.
But what about the role of the teacher to inspire, to challenge the students, like, if you know that they can do more, expect them to do more? Is this like just the thinking, okay, this is how much they want to give or to effort, or is I have a small experience teaching like elementary school. Like, I know that's distant.
So the question is,
if somebody chooses to get a B, what is that? Do we have a role to play in terms of trying to inspire them to work towards a higher grade, towards an A? I think that's a great question, and I think we can each handle it in our own way. And you might want to, if you begin to get assignments in when you see somebody's really doing well, you might want to say, are you sure you don't want to contract up to the next grade? You know, really, I can see a lot of opportunities for you. But regardless of which assignments, in my case, which assignments they chose, I expect excellence in those assignments. So whatever they're learning, they're still learning well. And they still had to submit the final assignment. They didn't get as much opportunity for the feedback. So I think it's a really great question to think about. So this approach may not work for you. It may not be a way you want to go, but it's anybody else have something to say about that? Any ideas? Yeah.
I just think that the contract is not fixed. So
yes.
Unfortunately, I think it can go either way in case somebody's struggling in the course. You know, they might have aspirations to do an A and then realize that they have to scale down, but I don't think the contract is fixed. And then
so I don't know if you could hear that. She said the contract doesn't have to be fixed in either way.
It could be contracted up or contracted down. I did ask people to write to me and say that they wanted to go up or down because, again, I think it's part of making a personal commitment to what you want to learn. But, yes, it can go either way. And, of course, they still had to reach the criteria. It wasn't just because they did it. It still had to be quality work. I'm going to just see if there were any others, and then we'll come back. Is anybody else? Yeah.
So, in class, comparing skills to students, so what level should we achieve to reach the best student, worst student?
All right, that's a tough one. In classes with varying skills, what level should we kind of aim towards or target? You know, the best level, lowest, highest.
That's a really hard question, and I don't know that I've actually settled in my own mind on the best way to approach that, except by having choices and some variability in assignments. Do other people, have you had to face that, and how have you approached it? Anybody? Yeah, that's, I think maybe having choices for me is what first comes to mind. Did you have some ideas about it? No, not particular. It's a challenge. Sorry, bonus questions? Okay. Yeah? Oh, sorry.
Optional assignments,
optional assessments. Yeah, that's the same notion, right? Something additional. Okay.
We try to balance between trying to be good teachers
right.
and doing what we came here to do, which is research. And that changes the balance even more so when you cross between graduate students, doctoral students, and postdocs. How much time do we invest? For those, it's great. I think it's a lot. But I don't have 65 hours a week to spend effectively coaching, never mind actively engaging with students, to get all my students to be B plus or A minus students. I simply don't have the time. And frankly, I have other stuff that I must do if I'm going to do this as an intellectual endeavor to take it seriously.
Well, we are a research-intensive university. That's what, McGill calls itself publicly funded, research-intensive, student-centered university. The student-centered has been added more recently because of this challenge for professors, and it's a huge challenge for professors and for graduate students to do research as well as doing teaching. And that's an ongoing discussion at the university. McGill has recently, now David mentioned this morning, a project that began a few years ago called the Nexus Between Research and Teaching. And the discourse now is that there should be a value added for undergraduates for coming to a research-intensive university. And what is that value added? That value added should be that they have some exposure to the research that's done here. Now, or the research, or what research is, what research entails. So it may not be that every student is doing undergraduate student's doing a research project, but that they are exposed to the way of thinking in a discipline and how research is done within a particular discipline. So that means that part of our responsibility as an academic is to help young people begin to understand the research way of thinking. So that's one piece, just to kind of contextualize it. Now, the other piece is time. Research is hugely time-consuming. So is teaching hugely time-consuming. There is an expectation at McGill, and it's very demanding that we be good teachers and good researchers. But I take your point that we can't put so much grading on ourselves that we can't get to our research or our other teaching obligations. And that's something that I really struggled with because I, for a while, went too far to the other side and spent too much time in assessment. And then I had to scale back again, which is why I went to peer and self-assessment, because it was impossible to have that much time and still carry out my research program. So I think we do always have to look for that balance that it's something, it is part of our responsibility. It's supposed to be at least 40% of our time is teaching, 40% of our time is research, or 50-40, and then another part of our time is service to the institution. So I think we have to try different things and try to get to that balance that allows us to enhance student learning, and you may not want to go all the way to portfolios, but to enhance student learning, really help students get the kind of learning you want them to get, but not take so much time that you're not able to do anything else. And speaking of giving feedback, you were talking about journaling and online. One of the instructors that we work with does it audio feedback online, which is much faster than giving written feedback, too. So she just, on my courses, she goes in and she gets the assignments and then speaks out loud and giving feedback. So it saves, it's a small time saver. Yeah, and then I think you had one too.
So I'm a teaching assistant. assistant, and there's three other teaching assistants and a professor for our lab. So there's five groups of students, and about every 2 weeks, we change groups of students. So as I'm watching your slides, and it says get to know people, get to know their names, but to me, that's impossible, because almost every second lab, and I also feel that if I didn't do something in one lab, there's a good chance that I will not see that group of students again. Mm-hmm. So do you have any suggestions how to deal with kind of a constantly changing group, yet trying to make sure that, and every group is different, so like their engagement is not the same. One lab, you have a great time, and another lab,
yeah, more energy, less energy, I know what you mean. So anybody have ideas? So she's saying,
with a constantly changing groups of labs that are coming through, students who are coming through in labs, it's going to be very difficult to learn their names, and you may not see them again. What are some strategies you could use to kind of connect to them? Any? Yeah?
In such situations, can help. Something happens a lot in the workshops.
Pre-test and post-test.
From the students, from their friends, and evaluate their knowledge in that topic, and then you will try to learn them, and when you take the post-test, you will know that you were successful.
Yeah, so successful in learning. And
you do remind me of another thing, is it wasn't really usually until I got the first assignments in that I really consolidated the names of who people were. So getting something written early. Now, this is there once in the lab or more than
really?
Twice. And you may not get to learn their names, but you could speak to them. Ask them a question, just make a small personal connection. I think that makes a difference, because in that situation, it may be difficult to learn everybody's name and certainly to remember them. I know some profs use pictures. They have in a big classroom like this, they use pictures and they ask for people to sit in the same place for a while so that they can learn the faces. Yeah.
You can't remember the name of your students, but you can remember the name of your colleagues. So sometimes you can refer to your colleague, the other TAs, and then you can make a common ground to talk to them. So for example, you may want to ask what's happened in the other class with the other TA, or just a small story about the other TA or something like that.
So connecting across the TAs, connecting across groups in some way, which may mean that you come together to know the group of students, and I think that's what you're saying.
David, 2 minutes. 2 minutes.
I was looking at Tyler. Sorry. You manage, with assignments and how to get B minus, D, and so on. But I was wondering, how exactly could we apply that to science courses? I feel if you don't evaluate students, how are you going to know if they know it or not? And you said, there's a renowned teacher that won some type of award in biology
teacher.
And how does he go about that? Biology is the science course, so what do you do?
Well, one of the things that
Tom Haffey is his name, Haffie. You could look him up. He's a 3M Teaching Award winner, which is a national award, and he's won a couple of other big teaching awards. He actually uses clickers, and that's one way he gets students thinking at a different level. But he doesn't use yes-no questions or just simple multiple choice. His are very much questions that don't have answers, and there's a lot of talking going on. And he teaches enormous classes of thousands of students. And I could actually communicate with him and find out how he goes about the assessment. But what he's always working towards is the higher level of learning. He probably doesn't use portfolios, but he does go for the higher levels of learning and not just for the factual recollection. It's learning how to make decisions, learning how to evaluate evidence, and so on. So if maybe that's something, too, David, we want to think about is connecting to some of Tom's materials on the site. Oh, I think this means I'm done. Thank you. Thank you.
So
So, ladies and gentlemen, this has been your morning plenary with Professor Cynthia Weston. Thank you, Cynthia. That was amazing. And we will follow up with some of the things that you've talked about. We'll put the assessment information on. Tom Haffey is actually hosting a science education conference this summer. I think it's July. It'll be at Western. Okay. And
did you hear that? He's hosting a conference this summer at Western.
And I also, while we have you here, it's really been an interesting talk. And Cynthia will be leaving Teaching and Learning Services at the end of our summer. So we really appreciate that you could do this for us this morning. Ladies and gentlemen, Cynthia Weston.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thanks for your great questions. And good luck. Enjoy your teaching experience.